Blog Talk Radio.
Let me guess. Berkeley?
Brown, actually.
Well, Ms. Brown, it's an imperfect world, but it's the only one we've got. I guarantee you, the day weapons are no longer needed to keep the peace, I'll start making bricks and beans for baby hospitals.
You rehearse that much?
Every night in front of the mirror before bedtime.
I can see that.
I'd like to show you firsthand.
Daryl, are you there?
Yep, here. Okay.
Sorry about that, folks. Live radio. Let's go to a quick groove. Daryl, did you hear the intro?
No, I didn't. So let's roll
All
with
right.
this.
All right. It is what it is, folks. Again, welcome to the Comic Shop, the Grindhouse Edition. Let's go to a quick groove, Daryl, and then let me get the captain, and we'll just... We'll act like this never happened.
We'll wing it.
Okay, hold on.
Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane!
No, it's Max, Daryl, and D-Bert, your host for the Comic Shop Show.
Okay. Astro nerd.
He fixed one thing, another thing broke down. Who knew
wow.
we were there
wow.
we're serving on Firefly here tonight. Yeah, I know. Let's start this over again. Folks, welcome to the Comic Shop. This is the Grindhouse Edition. Apologies all abound. These things happen. Time for an ultimate reboot, an ultimate redo for what has just happened. The call-in number is 646-915-9620. Again, 646-915-9620. We are expecting Mr. Matt Crane, who is a graphic designer. I'm pretty sure that Daryl B. is on board for this. At least I think he is. Did you see this whole thing? He's promoting a Kickstarter.
The Sesame Street Fighter? Yeah, sorry.
I think it's brilliant. Right? But, you know... Hey,
It's brilliant until trademarks come into play here.
Yeah, we're going to ask about that. Again, we're expecting Mr. Matt Crane to discuss his Kickstarter campaign, Sesame Street Fighter. So I think the look of it, you have to admit, Daryl, that these characters seem to mesh you know, seamlessly with Sesame Street.
Yeah, and that's one of the benefits of Kickstarter, is no longer can you say, sorry about that, I'm in the middle of a windstorm right now, go like, no longer can you say, well, I have this idea, but I have no way to get it out. You know, you got an idea, you know, you could go right on Kickstarter and go, I think this could work. All I need is this to help me. And it's given a lot of people a chance.
Exactly. While we're waiting for him, because again, he's calling from Mountain Time, hopefully it's not a mix-up. If there is a mix-up, then we will reschedule. But while we're waiting for Mr. Crane to come through, let's talk about this deal with Robin.
Oh,
death,
God.
Damian Wayne. Even beyond his death, his comic book death, I should say, folks, is the media's penchant for always giving us these spoilers. Why can't they talk about this once the issue has been released? Daryl, just take this over. Give us your thoughts on this. Again, this was Batman Incorporated number 8, I believe?
Yes, it was.
Which
I will say this, the media thing worked because you can't find an issue of it outside of the variant all over New York City. I'll say that because I've had a bunch of people go, Daryl, you got to get me this. Oh, my God, Robin's going to die. And I'm like, it's happened before, but I'll go and look for you. You know, I'm like, okay, all right. But I said it in the blog. I'll say it like this. What other art form will give away the ending or a major plot point in a paper? All right? Like, if we watch Crying Game and we knew that before, like, oh, in Crying Game, guess what? The chick isn't a chick. You know? If we watch Usual Suspects and a couple of days before Usual Suspects come out, you know, a major newspaper chain goes, you know, Kaiser Sose, it isn't who you think he is. You know, if that came out, we would all be mad. That's why I don't understand when I riff on the comics for doing this, people get mad at me, and I go like, but my thing for reading it is the story unfolding, the adventure. You gave me that plot point. Why should I pick up the book? Why? Back to you after that.
Yeah, actually, you know what? I think our special guest has arrived. Let me look out the window. Mr. Crane.
Yes, sir.
Welcome to Afternoon Radio, or I should say Comic Shop this time. The Comic Shop, welcome.
Yeah. I am so glad to be here. I really sincerely appreciate you guys giving me a little bit of time. Thank you so much.
Oh, no problem. Listen, I got your email, and obviously you went to the right place. Anything that has nerd in its title would probably
oh,
dig what
God.
You're doing. So it's a sure
I was hoping
bet.
So.
It's a sure bet that we're going to get what you're doing. So if you could just explain to the audience, tell us how you arrived at this Kickstarter campaign, just what's going on here.
Yeah. Well, so I'm a pretty nerdy dude. Like, let's just get that out there, you know, right from the beginning. You know, I played a lot of video games growing up. You know, my friends were into role-playing and stuff like that. So it's, you know, it's a world I'm fairly familiar with. You know, I was born in 79. You know, I'm in my 30s now. So in the 80s, as a kid, I grew up watching Sesame Street a lot, right? And so, of course, I got to love Bert, Ernie, all those classic Sesame Street characters. And, you know, that was a big part of my childhood, loved the show. And, you know, I love Jim Henson's other stuff, too, like the movies. I mean, even Dark Crystal and stuff like that. Of course, I watched those shows as a kid. Muppet Show too, of course, was great. You know, that was big back then. And then as I got into my teenage years in the 90s, you know, I would go to arcades, and this thing called Street Fighter happened. And that was amazing. I mean, I remember the first time I saw Street Fighter 2, it was mind-blowing back then. I mean, you know, the graphics aren't going to impress anybody who didn't sort of, you know, go through that arcade phase of video games. You know, the graphics aren't impressive by today's standards, you know, in at least in a technical aspect. But, you know, back then, that was mind-blowing to see those characters and those incredible graphics in the arcades. And, you know, I fell in love with that game, man. Like, Street Fighter 2, that game was amazing. I absolutely loved it. And, you know, I grew up in a family where we didn't have a whole ton of money. And, you know, it was kind of a big deal for me to have a couple of quarters in my pocket and be able to shove them into a Street Fighter machine and play for a while. So anyways, yeah, you know, I grew up with both of those things. And, you know, sometime around when I was a teenager, I had the idea, oh, Sesame Street Fighter, you know, that's so funny. What a clever idea. And I don't in any way want anyone to think that I'm like the first dude who ever thought of that, or like the only guy who ever thought of it. You know, I'm sure lots of us kind of thought that would be sort of a funny parody back in the day when it happened. But when I was a teenager, you know, I didn't ever really do anything about it other than a few sketches. You know, like I did a few drawings back then, but that was it. So hopefully I'm not taking too long for this explanation here. But flash forward, you know, to where I actually start to get into a career as a graphic designer. You know, I go to college. I learn how to do graphic design, and I start to learn how to do more things with illustration and artwork as well. And, you know, I learn new skills, learn how to use software and things like that. And so I start to get a little bit more sophisticated with my artwork. And, you know, around 2009, Capcom sort of digs the Street Fighter franchise out of its grave and brings it back to life and releases Street Fighter 4. You know, the franchise had been dormant for a long time, but they finally come out with this new game, and everybody loves it. And it's good. It's a really good game. And, I think that sort of motivated me to finally, like, stop just, you know, thinking about the Sesame Street Fighter idea, but actually do something about it. Because, you know, ever since I'd been in junior high, I always thought it was a funny idea. You know, it was something that I always – it would make me chuckle whenever I think about it. So, you know, I finally just decided, okay, well, I have everything I need to do some artwork. Let's just do it. And, you know, I got onto DeviantArt.com and started posting my stuff in 2009. And so I've been doing it ever since then. Like, I've just been putting, you know, Sesame Street Fighter artwork on DeviantArt since 2009. I've been having fun, you know, and it hasn't been like a, you know, like a career move or anything like that. It's just been a hobby, you know, something I've done for fun. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, just one thing also as I think about this. I mean, I dig the look, obviously. Now, you mentioned in your pitch on Kickstarter that you received some notoriety, maybe not welcome notoriety, but notoriety nevertheless, from Capcom. You were on Capcom's website, and something happened from that. What happened when you were on Capcom's website with this Sesame Street Fighter thing?
Yeah, there's what I think is an interesting story behind that. Hopefully you guys will think it's interesting too. There's a gentleman who blogged about this. I can't remember his name right now, but there's a guy who basically interviewed me via email about this whole story. But when I started posting this artwork, it got picked up by Seth Killian, who used to work for Capcom. Now that name is a big name amongst people who are Street Fighter diehards. Like arguably, he's the guy who kind of convinced Capcom to get Street Fighter going again and create Street Fighter 4. Because, you know, Street Fighter 3 had like three iterations. I think Third Strike was the last one, and that had been done a long time ago. But Seth Killian was – so anyways, yeah, Seth Killian, big name among Street Fighter, you know, diehards. And he basically on some Capcom forums, he, you know, got wind of my artwork. I might have even emailed him about it. I don't know. Like, I was just trying to get it out there, just like I did with you guys. Like, you know,
right.
I don't have a budget. Like, I don't have a marketing budget. So what do? I send emails to total strangers, and I hope that if I'm lucky, they'll invite me onto their radio show and let me blab, right? So that's what I did.
It's the hustling, you know, and the new age.
Yeah. I'm e-hustling.
Yeah.
So I did the same thing, and I was lucky. I mean, I was just lucky that
that he gave me the time of day. And, you know, like you alluded to, like he – so he posted about my artwork, and he was like, you know, this is kind of creepy. I don't know what I think about this, but here it is, guys. What do you think? And fine, you know, like it wasn't like real positive stuff, but I've been kind of learning, you know, that it's better to have somebody talk crap about what you do than to not talk about you at all. I mean, if you're trying to get something in front of people, right?
Absolutely.
Well, I tell you something. I want Daryl to come in a moment, Daryl B. Daryl, just one moment, though. With this idea, well, first of all, it's almost insulting for Capcom to get on you about this, because Capcom, as of late, has been the master, as we said, master of the remix, where all these properties, you know, you have Marvel versus Capcom, all these properties, I think they might be angry because they didn't think of it. To me, I can see it easily. I could see this easily as some kind of downloadable content thing. Easily. I mean, the way these characters are almost seamlessly, I mean, it's the way they seamlessly fit. You know, Bert and Ernie, I mean, they've made jokes about them, you know, over the years. You know,
right,
now we're in a new world. Now we're in a new world, two guys living together. That goes somewhere. So it was innocent when I was a kid. Now it's not so innocent. Nevertheless.
Yeah, it means something different now, doesn't it? Yeah.
But those guys as Ken and Ryu, it fits seamlessly. I mean, I don't see why Capcom wouldn't pick this up, or I wouldn't be surprised if they do pick it up, because at least as some kind of side thing or some way of this is how you rejuvenate the juices for these properties. Daryl, you probably have a question. What are your thoughts?
I look at it like this. Hey, Angry Birds is doing Star Wars. I mean, Angry Birds and Star Wars. You know what I mean? You could do this like a 99-cent downloadable thing for a console, to like a throwaway, you know? Hell, Yahoo had their own mini Street Fighter thing in the beginning when they were doing Messenger. You know, the way I look at it is, Capcom did a Lupe fiasco here by like crapping on it early. Because if it's cheesy yet pays homage to the series, you could rope in a whole new generation of players. I look at it this way. You have the imagination to pull it off. You went to Kickstarter. This seed is now implanted in gamers' heads. And already you hear a little thing like, okay, well, would that make Elmo Blanca? Wait, no. Snuffleupagus could be Blanca. Wait, Big Bird is going to be Zangrief. Oh, wait, who would be Balrog in this situation? You know, and sir, that's why I appreciate you putting it out there, because I was telling the guys before, that's the beauty of Kickstarter. You have the idea. There's no excuse to just sit on it now. If you're motivated enough, put it out there. You never know who would like it. And being a longtime fan of Sesame Street, I just want Kermit as one of the hidden bosses. Kermit and
Captain, I'm sure you have a question.
No, here's the thing. I think Capcom could be persuaded down the line. What are your thoughts pertaining to Sesame Street? Do you think Sesame Street might be the roadblock in the big deal or potential big deal, if there is a big deal down the line? Just your thoughts on that pertaining to Sesame Street.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. Like, to be honest with you guys, I didn't do this for years because I love Jim Henson, man. Like, I'm a big fan. And then, you know, on one hand, you can say, well, okay, you're taking these lovable puppets that were used to teach children, and then you're mixing them with this video game where people beat the crap out of each other, right? So. Isn't that disrespectful? And so I was thinking about that, and for years, I was like, you know, I don't want to do something that Jim Henson would not like or that he would not approve of. But then, you know, what's funny is what changed it for me is I started watching episodes of The Muppet Show, the original, and you know, there's some kind of edgy stuff in there. I mean, it's violent sometimes too.
True.
It's kicking the crap out of somebody, not always, but karate chop somebody or kick them. And if you look, like, when Jim Henson was alive, they did some funny parody stuff with the Muppets. And they still do parodies on Sesame Street to this day. And so I sort of came to this realization. I was like, you know, if Jim Henson is up there in heaven looking down on this right now, I can't speak for him. I don't want to be pretentious or do anything ridiculous like that. But honestly, after
after sort of looking at what he did with the Muppets and the parodies on Sesame Street and stuff, I think he would just laugh about it. I don't think he'd be upset, honestly. And back to the question, like, would this ever work with PBS and Sesame Street? I don't think so. Like, making an actual game out of it, I don't think it's actually going to happen. And that was one thing I wanted to tell you guys about this whole story. I don't think Capcom would go for it either, because they actually they actually sent me a cease and desist letter. Not for this Kickstarter. Let me be clear on that. Not for this Kickstarter, but I have actually been selling this artwork on T-shirts and things like that on a website called Redbubble.com. And the reason I have done that on this particular website is that if you go to Redbubble.com and you look, they will allow artists like myself to do parody artwork and sell it on stuff like T-shirts or whatever, where a lot of other websites like Cafe Press or whatever else won't let you do that. And so, I got a cease and desist. Actually, I should say Redbubble got a cease and desist. They got a cease and desist from Capcom because of these shirts that I'm selling. I'm still selling to this day on this website. And, you know, honestly, like, I don't hate Capcom. Like, they've made some stupid decisions as a company with, you know, DLC, you know, like, stuff that's on game disc that they're charging you for already on stuff like that. Yeah, they've messed up on some things like that. But I don't necessarily fault them for trying to protect their intellectual properties or whatever. But the thing is, like, it's a parody, right? Like, I'm not just doing, like, drawings of Ryu or doing drawings of Kermit and, like, just selling them like those are my properties and I can do whatever I want with them. I'm doing a parody, you know? And you know, thanks to this website, Redbubble, they actually gave me some advice. You know, they told me where to go and where to get forms to counter the cease and desist from Capcom, and so I did it. You know, like, all I had to do was just fill out some forms and, you know, shoot this email off to Capcom. That doesn't mean that Capcom isn't still, you know, pissed about it or whatever. But the thing is, like, if they wanted to take it further than sending a cease and desist, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is that they would have to actually bring up some kind of lawsuit or whatever.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about this. You know, look at how Mad and Cracked have been around. Well, Mad has been around for almost 60 years. And, Mad has Alfred E. Newman as Batman, as whatever. These things have been going on for decades. So if you're under the premise of a parody, they're going to have a difficult time. Everyone does some kind of parody on someone else.
Yeah.
Even graphically. Graphically, you know, the magazine covers are every magazine issue is a intellectual property nightmare, I would think. But, and yet they still exist. Why is... Mad Magazine allowed to parody something and nothing comes out of it? What's the difference between what you're doing and what Crack or Mad does? Or anyone else?
That's comedy, a really good point.
Comedy is rife. Comedy is rife with parody.
Yeah, I think with Capcom, you know, there's probably like a legal branch and then, like, you know, they're probably totally separate from the guys who make the games. And so, like, maybe some American Capcom employees who are part of our culture and who understand parody and have grown up with it, you know, they might look at what I did. Like Seth Killian, honestly, like, I think he just looked at what I did and he had a good laugh at it. You know, and that's what I would expect from somebody, like, in an American culture who understands parody. But they're a Japanese company. Like, I don't really know anything about Japan, but maybe parody is just not part of their universe, you know, like, that maybe that's just something that doesn't exist in Japan, or at least not in the form that I'm doing it here. I don't know. It may have just been completely foreign or something to them. I don't know about that because
I know full and well, I forgot, one of the creators behind Capcom, he was lauding over the fact that he'd like to have a DC versus Marvel Capcom game.
Oh, that'd be great.
We always wanted that. We want some kind of DC Marvel.
Everybody
wants
that.
It is a perfect reason to back up the Brinks truck for a Marvel versus DC thing. I don't know, but
yes,
and
sir.
He said he's willing to do it, but he's trying to get Warner Brothers and now Disney together to try to get this going on.
That'd be so great. I'll tell you this right now.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say this. I would take every dime, and I'm not making a ton of money off this Kickstarter. Like, I'm grateful for every dime I get because this is just kind of a hobby-like thing. Like, this isn't my career. But I would give every dime I make off of this Kickstarter thing for a copy of of Marvel versus DC made by Capcom.
Oh,
I would buy that game.
That's a real geek right there.
The gentleman behind Capcom, I think it was on comicbookmovie.com or one of these websites, he himself had said that what they asked him, what would your dream project be? He said that would be the project, but it would be a matter of getting these corporations together to agree to it. You can barely get these guys together to do a comic book, let alone a they've been wanting this for since the beginning of basically these type of games being created. Matt, we have to do another segment, but
You just got to sit down and just look at the corporations at the end of the day and go like, why do you hate geeks and why do you hate to make money?
Well, and you know, I know you guys are moving on. I'm just going to say something real quick in Capcom's defense. You know, there was a fan who made a Mega Man versus Street Fighter game, and he was just doing it as a fan. And Capcom recently bought that game from him and gave it away for free. You know, they could have just shut it down and been like, you know, F you can't do that with our stuff. It wasn't our idea. But they bought the game, and they gave it away for free. So I hope that they're changing. You know, I hope that instead of sending me cease and desist letters, people at Capcom are going to look at this Kickstarter and just be like, you know what, that's funny, and it's not hurting us. Because it's not. Like, I don't want to hurt Capcom. You know, even though they've made some bad decisions as a company, I like them. I love Street Fighter. I love Sesame Street, and I'm not trying to do something that's hurting them. You know, it's a love letter. I mean, it's my way of, I guess, showing my love for those two franchises, and you know, I love both of them.
Well, I'll leave you with this. These corporations are learning the hard way with the internet and social media. We saw this with Napster 15 years ago now, I guess, that now the record industry is in shambles because of them denying ingenuity coming from the internet or ingenuity coming from cyberspace. They denied that. Now they're taking a loss. Now social media is what's creating these kind of things because people are creative and they're thinking. Instead of trying to embrace you and your idea, they're going to end up losing in the end, I believe. So I support your idea. I hope I'm able to see it to its fruition. I think it's interesting, definitely. Give us more information about your Kickstarter. Where to go to contribute to your graphics.
Oh, yeah, you bet. Yeah, if you just go to Kickstarter.com, it's going to be – they have sections, and there's an art section. They also have a search box. You know, if you just type in, you know, Sesame Street or Sesame Street Fighter in Kickstarter's little search box on their website, you'll find it. You know, I have good news. It actually funded today. So I hit that $1,000 mark. So,
terrific.
That's awesome.
Congratulations.
Thank you, man. And it's thanks to, you know, it's thanks to guys like you who are helping me get the word out there. I really appreciate you guys, you know, letting me on the show. And, you know, I have not listened to you guys previously. Like, I was just trying to find anybody I could and get them to talk about this. So I hadn't listened to your show before I sent you that first email. But, you know, I listened to the episode about the Orson Scott Card stuff and the Jesus is My End stuff. And that was an awesome episode. I mean, you guys have helped me a lot more than I'm helping you. But, I'm a listener from here on out. Like, and especially a podcast that, you know, is clean too. Like it's hard to find podcasts where you don't hear a whole lot of cursing, and especially hard to find podcasts where people are, you know, coming down on some of this morally negative stuff that's out there in media and things like that. And I admire what you guys are doing, and I'm going to keep listening. You know, you guys got a new fan.
It's awesome.
We appreciate it.
They hit me up with volume before the show, so I'm unable to curse. So that's it.
Well, we try to keep it clean. Sometimes the music, we try to keep it clean. On occasion, the music, you know, the music and some of the clips we play may get a little racy because, well, that's, you know, it's hard to kind of edit that stuff.
Right.
But
we try
to keep things clean.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And the reason I appreciate it, you know, I'll be upfront with you guys. I swear sometimes. That's something I've been trying to, you know, cut down on. I've got kids. I don't want to hear them swearing. And so, I try to cut back. I try not to swear. And if I listen to a podcast where, you know, it's cursing left and right, then I'm more likely to hear it out of my mouth and more likely to hear it out of my kid's mouth. And I don't want that. So, anyways, I appreciate what you guys are doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sir. And we'll keep in touch, and we'll continue to support what you're doing. Thanks,
oh,
man.
Thanks so much. Thank you, guys. Take care.
You too. Check out Kickstarter campaign, Sesame Street Fighter. I just think it's just Sesame Street Fighter. Who could deny that?
Haruka.
Right. Yeah. Haruka.
Oscar the Grouch as Bison. That's all you need to know.
Miss Piggy as Chun-Li. I mean, this stuff is kind of, you know, I just like the fact
that all those characters
just fit. That's what would be brilliant, you know?
Hey,
all right, let's go to a quick groove. We'll get back. Talk a little bit about the death of Robin, and then I want to actually talk about another Kickstarter campaign regarding the death of Superman. The death of Superman lives, I should say. We're going to have to talk to that gentleman, too. So let's go to a quick groove. This is Hank Pym. Hank Pym. We'll be right back.
So what's up, man?
Cooling, man.
Chilling? Yo, you know I had to call. You know why, right?
Why?
Because. Yo, I never, ever call and ask you to play something, right?
Yeah.
You know what I want to hear.
What you want to hear?
I want to hear that Warrock joint.
Adam Warrock again?
Oh, yeah, again and again.
Schizophrenic rap attack, mad after the fact. Just a man who wants his fucking life back. Addicted to the Prozac, haters on the Bozak. West Coast rap, so you better know that, yo. Kojak couldn't catch the flow. A Kojak with the cold rap attack and a hoe, you know. Diggity sick on the miggity miggity microphone. Didn't you get all the shit you needed to type a poem? Cause every day my brain is getting much bigger, while my bank account is shrinking as I'm spending much quicker. And you know that shit flicker, that I spit it much sicker. And I'm drinking Alizé as I'm killing off my liver. I'm up and down like the rodeo show, and I've been working in the studio, trying not to grow. Much bigger than my britches, hitting switches, cause it's Mrs. Hank Pym who be getting in my business.
Murder, happy big mouth!
You're a happy big mouth!
One of these days, Alice, one of these days! All right, that's it!
Jiggity check yourself before you wreck yourself. Jiggity check yourself before you wreck yourself. While I'm skipping through the market for them pimp articles, dressed in all yellow like a fly fellow. Watch as I attack and hate it, best to wear they jacket. Because it's cold, come on, because I'm so evil with the flow, like I just created Ultron. Calling me Goliath and you got the slingshot. Watch me rewrite the good book, you better think not.
Scientists, dudes got crazy game. While going to the best scenes, it's like LeBron James. Let's go to Avengers, do our thing. While we messing with the wasps, it's sick as a bee sting.
Folks, welcome once again to the Comic Shop, the Grindhouse Edition. We want to thank Matt Crane with his Sesame Street Fighter for stopping by. Definitely go to Kickstarter. I'm going to talk about another Kickstarter campaign in a few moments. That's interesting. Now, after having played that jam, gentlemen, it reminds you of just how much the remix has affected our lives. Because, first of all, Adam Warrock is based on Adam Warlock, the Marvel character, who we may see in Avengers 2. You never know. So you have that going on. You have him sampling the infamous hit from, oh, Jesus, the Grandmaster Flash. So, I mean, hip-hop is rife with the sample, sampling other people's work. So for what Matt has done as far as his version of the remix, that's life for the last 30 years, hasn't it? That's life for the last 30 years, the remix in some way. I don't know why we're not embracing this.
You know what it is, too. And you know, I could see the big corporations why they get mad. Some of like the original artists, why they get mad. But sometimes, you know, you hear the remix and stuff, or you see the redo, and it makes you want to go back and find the original work. I keep on telling people whenever I'm a hip hop fan, and I get good hip hop. But if I get a really good beat or a really good song, I want the original too. So not only do I get the hip-hop track, but I go back and get the old track. I wouldn't know about Willie Hutch. I wouldn't know about Tom Scott. I wouldn't know about Ella Fitzgerald and some of the stuff if I didn't see the raps that sampled their songs, looked up the songs, and went and got those old albums.
Definitely, definitely. Listen, let's get back into the fold. We were talking about initially the death of Damian Wayne, a.k.a. Robin. I would assume, listen, he is Ra's al Ghul's grandson, so I find it hard to believe with that connection that he's not going to somehow reappear. I'm just putting it out there. And no one ever really dies except for Uncle Ben. Uncle Ben has stayed dead for 50-plus years now, or 50 years, I should say. Now, yeah, I think about 50 years he's been dead. So what are your thoughts on this, Daryl? You know, go back into this a little bit for our audience. The newspapers, they are already telegraphing this stuff before the audience can be surprised by it. Will that ever stop?
Well, like I said, I have no questions about the death. The death, A, you know, there was a great article in Robot 6 that had a quote from Morrison about killing off Robin, and then they showed the history of him killing off characters he created. You know, he didn't create Robin, but he created Damian Wayne. Well, he created the new version of Damian Wayne. The baby was long. It's been in continuity past since what was it? Son of the Demon, Birth of the Demon. I forget which trade it was, but. You know, the Damian Wayne character is there. What got me mad is, once again, you go and put it in the newspaper beforehand. How much bigger would that issue have been to longtime readers if it shocked everybody when it happened? You know, like I said, it worked. A lot of people who don't collect comics ran into their shops because they're like the Cinema Bat fans or whatever, and they saw, oh my God, he gets killed, and went and picked up the book. Like I said, in New York, you cannot find the issue. I'm telling you that straight out. But to me, what other art form spoils their plot in the newspaper beforehand? There's something wrong there. Back to you.
Yeah, Captain, thoughts on this death, another death, another Robin?
Well, if you knew the criminal activity before the criminal would do it, what would we be calling it? Minority Report.
Good point.
Well, you know, that definitely does seem to work for the comic book world. It builds not so much tension. There's not tension at that given point. It's just the general excitement. I need to be in on it. So even if you're not into comic books, all of a sudden now you're talking about, hey, did you hear that Robin died? Did you hear the end? Yeah, it's the umpteenth time. No big problem. People die all the time in the comic book universe. Then they bring them back. This is what they do. No, but you have to get it. You have to get it. He died. I agree with Daryl. I think it would be better, if there weren't any spoilers. You didn't know what was going on. I think it would definitely be more dramatic when you pick up the book and you begin to read it. It'd really take you on a journey when you read that book. I agree with that. But the early spoiler seems to do a lot when it comes to the sales. It definitely seems to do a lot also that way. You know, so they essentially are saying, the hell with us, geeks and nerds.
It's all about the green.
It's all about the green. Let's back the Brinks truck. Right up. Back over to you, Sir Afro-Nerd.
Yeah, I want to move to the next topic. I will say this, though. It really has come down to the speculators. It is very much about finance. And as a collector, I will confess that I collect comic books. I'm probably one of those rare comic book guys that collects comics from all sides. I collect it for value, but I also collect it for the art. I collect it for the stories. But there are some folks, many, who are calling it. I know our friend Donna from Superhero Comics in Floral Park, New York. Incidentally, folks, if you'd like to stop by, just mention Afro Nerd, Afro Nerd Radio, Daryl B. She talked to me, and we spoke about this, that people were calling in, the phone was ringing, and they were not collectors. I think she would actually, because of who she is, she would question their motives, and they weren't into comic books. They were into the idea of speculating, you know, wrapping this thing up, and you never thought you would see a day when someone would come in and just collect comics this way. But because of the current financial state that we're in, if it's not gold, if it's not platinum, it might as well be comic books. We've seen stories of people who are able to forestall foreclosure on their homes because they had Action Number One in their attic. And this sounds like a movie setup, but this is reality. There are folks that might have had comic books, didn't know what they had necessarily, but when it came down to saving a home, folks, you can Google this. There was some family that was able to save their home because they had a $200,000 plus valued copy of Action Comics laying around. So this is what has given birth to this kind of world we're living in now. We have speculators who are trying to collect comic books for different reasons. All right, listen, let's move to another topic. I want to talk about actually another Kickstarter campaign, and it's by a Mr. John Schnepp, who I'm going to have to reach out to. This, I have to admit, I'm curious about. It's revolving around this Tim Burton, this failed Tim Burton Superman reboot project. I believe around 97, 98, there was a proposal ready to be, I think, almost green-lighted. Daryl could probably talk more insightfully about this. But between Kevin Smith writing this script and Tim Burton actually directing it, and having Nick Cage as Clark Kent, this is going to be a wacky take on Superman. And this is way before Superman Returns. So, Daryl, give us your thoughts on this. Now, this Kickstarter campaign is a documentary that this gentleman is funding or seeking funding for, to go in depth with interviews, with storyboard art, with a whole in-depth view of what was going on when this was actually, when the wheels were turning and this coming to life, this Superman Lives Tim Burton vehicle. What are your thoughts about this documentary, and what are your thoughts about this whole, I mean, it's legendary, this film.
Yeah, it's one of the closest things comics has got to a true urban legend, because there's been so much misinformation put out about this. There's been so much truth put out about this. I remember, I think 2-3 years ago, Kevin Smith actually put the script out. The script is actually out there online of that he wrote for this film. You know, every couple of months, it seems like you get a new picture of Nicolas Cage in the Superman costume and stuff like that. I gave into this Kickstarter because I really want to know what the true story is here. And the funny thing is, Kevin Smith will talk about it, Nicolas Cage will talk about it, but Tim Burton hasn't said a word about this, and I kind of want to know what was going through Tim Burton's head, or what his motivation was. His motivation was to make money, but because DC already screwed him with the Bat franchise, and yet he still approached Kevin Smith about doing the script, and got Nicolas Cage was all in before he even saw the script. I'm all in, because Nicolas Cage is a Superman freak. I'm all in. Let's do this. Let's get this on. And DC nixed it. I really want to hear the story behind this.
We have to say a couple of things as well. that the folks involved in this were involved in this now were real, real comic book guys. You know, Tim Burton has that visual technique. Love him or hate him, he does have, you know, when you're looking at a Tim Burton film. Also, Kevin Smith is the ultimate. He owns a comic book store. And with Nick Cage, first of all, he's really Nicholas Coppola. He's Nick Cage because of his love for Luke Cage as a child, that character. So he named himself Nicholas Cage after Luke Cage. And his firstborn is named Kal-El. So he is a real comic book guy. Now, I want the captain to come in on this. Now, we talk about Afro Nerd Unchained or Afro Nerd After Dark. There's also a comic book shop, a comic shop After Dark, a comic shop Unchained, where we have all these very passionate conversations that we try to, you know, reenact, as it were, for the show live. But we were talking about that. I want the captain to expound on this. This whole deal about his vision being a little bit too wacky for diehard Superman fans and comic book fans, but we might have to understand something. Darryl understands this too. As a comic book aficionado, we're used to alternatives. We're used to different universes, different takes, past takes on things, future takes on things, alternate universes. So I think there's going to have to come a time with this new world of comic book movies that we're going to have to see alternate comic book movies. Maybe it might have to be, well, I know we would like to see it, this Black Spider-Man movie, because he exists in the comic books. I mean, the reason why you have Sam Jackson as Nick Cage is because of an alternative timeline, alternative vision.
As Nick Cage? Nick Fury. You see, you got Cage on your head.
Sorry about that. Nick Fury. I did one of those Obama slip-ups, Darryl. Excuse me for that.
Oops.
Go ahead.
Yeah. But I look at it this way.
I want the captain to answer.
Go ahead, Steve.
Now, here's the reality of the situation. I think we might be reading into it too deep. Tim Burton didn't have Johnny Depp, so forget it right there. All right? Then we bring in Nicolas Cage. All right? We see now we got after the fact. We see Nicolas Cage in Ghost Rider. Now, it's nice that Nicolas, you know, likes Superman and everything else, but just because you like the role does not mean you're ready for the role. Okay? That being said, it's one thing to dress in a suit. Now, follow my analogy here. You got on a black suit, gray suit, blue suit. You wear nice, solid colors, and you're going in a job interview. Now, here's another thing. You come in there looking like a pimp, you get an entirely different reaction. Tim Burton is the pimp. You understand? He's the pimp. And at the given time, I don't think the pimp look would have worked. It may work now after we get the real Superman movie that's coming out in June. You know, then we can go that route. Let's pimp it out. Let's put on the crazy colors, the crazy shoes, the crazy hat. Go ahead, Tim. Alternate universe and everything else. But let's lay the foundation and get the foundation correct, then we can do everything else, you know? And sometimes you don't need to do that. If you buy a nice car, you don't have to trick it out and put crazy rims on, and you see these down south fools doing, these West Coast fools at times. The car is already nice. You're messing it up, but sometimes it does work. But whatever you do, you must lay the foundation first. We have the Christopher Reeves version of Superman. Every other Superman movie after that has been hell of a boo. Nonsense. So let's get the real good Superman, and then maybe we can go back to this Tim Burton situation. So in my opinion, at the given time, it just didn't work. They went together and said, no, this doesn't work. This doesn't work. This doesn't work. That's all.
Let me go to Darryl.
I want to pose this to you. I want you to say your piece, but I want to say this quickly. Okay. Do you think there will ever be a place for people to give these artists, someone like Tim Burton or anyone, to really give their vision of a particular character? I mean, the fact that we just spoke to this gentleman that came up with the Sesame Street Fighter thing, it plays into this whole deal, which is very much a part of comic book lore, Darryl, that there are, you know, they have, you have What If is coming back, by the way, for those folks that may be unknown. What If is a Marvel franchise that's been around for 30-plus years where they pose these questions, a comic book based on the question, what if Spider-Man got a different power? What if Iron Man, what if Tony Stark didn't become Iron Man? I mean, there's all these different questions that are interesting. And that's part of the comic book world. When can we see that interpreted on screen? I mean, we did see Freddy versus Jason. We did see the Predator versus Alien, Alien versus Predator. So there is a place where you're going to want to see the remix.
Well, hey, you know, we got tons of Elseworld stories. We got tons of What If stories. But the problem is, there is no, you know, when it comes to putting it on TV or in movies, they want the sure thing. They want the sure deal. They don't F with the formula. Don't. This is the hero. This is how we're used to him. Let's do this. If you remember when X-Men First Class came out, you know, I was kind of against it in the beginning just because they kind of F'd with the formula, F with some of the characters. But it turned out to be a pretty decent movie. Sure, there was parts that pissed me all to hell, but it was a pretty decent movie, you know? But they tweaked it. They made it it was kind of like an alternate take, you know? The problem is, and the captain has said it before, these guys don't want their audience to think when it comes to superhero movies. We can't think. We, you know, it has to all be laid out. Hey, this is an alternate version of Superman. Let's go. There it goes. Pat.
Yeah, but you know what? My only problem with that thinking is when they try to do this, I'm talking about the suits now, when they try to do this, have this kind of mindset, well, we don't want the audience to think, they're screwing around with geeks that think. And the reason why some of the earlier projects failed is because they went off script. How can I put this? Because I'm going against my point. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that as long as there's some precedent for this, like we see that Guillermo del Toro is going to do JLA Dark, hopefully. I'm hearing it more and more that this thing may actually, we may see the light of day with this. I think that there should be some place in the film industry to allow for alternate takes as long as we are in on it, as long as we know it's an alternate take. I think the problem is don't give us something as if this is the standard. That's the problem. If we know it's not the standard, I think we'd be more open to it. This will be a great time to explore a Batman Beyond. Let's go to Bruce Wayne as an elderly person. That to me, I've said it before. Clint Eastwood would be an excellent elderly Batman. He would be excellent as an elderly Batman. Matter of fact, I think that there's talk that Arnold Schwarzenegger may return to the Terminator franchise, but you can't obviously have him as the Terminator robot. But it makes sense for him to be involved because, well, what was the human being, the original human being that the androids were based on? It just makes sense. I think in order to survive, you're going to have to do some things here and there to make the audience say, that's interesting. You can't always go back to the same thing because what's going to happen is Batman, they're treating Batman like, I said this behind the scenes, like James Bond. James Bond's been around for, 60 years if you include the James Bond in the 50s. So, I mean, are you going to keep on just putting someone in that bat suit and then that's the end of it? What are your thoughts on that?
Again, I look at it as this. It's entertainment. It's entertainment. It's not saving the world. It's not curing cancer. It's not curing AIDS. It's entertainment. There is going to be an audience for whatever. The problem is these guys want a surefire, with making $500 million without thinking type thing. And there's nothing here for fun.
like Captain said, it's all about the green. It's all about the green. Hence why the next X-Men film, you're going to get a lot of the old cast back in, you know? Hence why, you know, this Superman film, you know, after Returns blew up, they went and they did what they did, you know, to reboot it back to zero. They just want to do that. So good luck to them.
Quickly, because we got about 3 minutes, Daryl, and I also have to shout out Sergio Mims, his Shadow and Ad site. He had an interview with Halle Berry, and it was broken from his site, this story, that she's 90% sure, which is, you know, pretty reputable, obviously, 90% sure that she will be returning to this next installment of the X-Men. So what are your thoughts about not only that, Daryl, but Matthew Vaughn, who is connected with Fox, and with the last X-Men, but also with the Fantastic Four.
Hey, get it right. Get it right. You know, Days of Future Past, that is a beloved storyline. Get it right. You don't do stupid things like getting Sebastian Shaw's powers wrong. Don't do stupid things like killing all the black people or turning all the Latino people within 5 seconds of one another. Get it right. With Matthew Vaughn, remember the Fantastic Four, they are not superheroes. They're adventurers. They're scientists. They're a family. Remember that. That's the most important thing with the Fantastic Four. The superheroics are secondary to the adventure and the family building. You know, that's the problem with the second movie of Fantastic Four. They forgot family. They did. They went for the big time superhero type thing. They forgot science and they forgot family. So get it right.
Well, if you're to believe what they're saying that he's saying, Vaughn is saying that he's going to go more in depth into the backstory, into the history, into the science. So a lot of what you're saying, I mean, I have to admit that although I had problems with X-Men First Class, looking at that thing, it made me feel as if X-Men 1 came to life. I mean, just the costumes alone. It really, and plus it was the 60s. It had such a feel of that comic book. So, I mean, that was pretty revolutionary to me. For that, but there were problems with it, no less. I won't deny that. But it had a lot of a feel of that number one comic. I mean, wouldn't you say the same on that?
Yeah, Bandit. But yeah, again, go to the Captain again because he's been on point the last 3 weeks. That built a foundation. Don't mess it up.
Captain, any thoughts? We got about a minute before we go to the next door for our next show.
What was wrong with Fantastic Four, the movie, was the fact that it wasn't a comic. That's what was wrong with it. That's what was wrong. That's why they messed it up. And they just didn't know what they were doing. They just didn't know what they were doing.
And Jessica Alba,
comic.
And Jessica Alba in whiteface. I'll leave it at that. Jessica Alba in whiteface. I'll say that.
All right,
gentlemen, listen. It's been real. We got to move along. Daryl, next week. Do it.
Enjoy,
again.
Guys.
Spock with a beard?
I think not.
Your name is Toby. I want to hear you say it. Your name is Toby. You're going to learn to say your name. Let me hear you say it. What's your name?
Kunta. Kunta Kinte.
When the master gives you something, you take it. He gave you a name. It's a nice name. It's Toby. And it's going to be yours till the day you die. Now, I know you understand me. And I want to hear it. Again! What's your name?
Toby.
Hi. Say it again. Say it louder so they all can hear you. What's your name?
Toby. My name is Toby.
Hi. That's a good nigger.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else.
Hawk, who goes yonder?
It is I, sire, Richard of Nottingham.
Well, speak up, man. What is it?
News from the east, sire. Rick the Ruler has returned.
It's abracadabra, a la baby professor. All hail funkin' lesson. Sweet tongue, grand writer of scrolls. Now behold, let the legend unfold. Born in a cosmos where no time and space do exist. Vibe in the midst of the chaos. Mortals label me as a lock.
You're traveling to another radio show. A broadcast not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of the imagination. That's the on-air sign up ahead. Your next stop, Afro Nerve Radio, with your guide, Deeper, a.k.a. Afro Nerve.
Good evening, folks. Welcome to the home stretch. This is Afternoon featuring Captain Kirk. The call-in number 646-915-9620. Listen, you know that clip, as frightening as it is, I mean, it is still a harrowing audio. And if you remember the visual on that, again, from Roots, Vic Morrow, late actor Vic Morrow, and, of course, LeVar Burton, that was a really brutal scene. And although we have fondness for Django, we still have to remember the Roots was what it was for what, you know, for its time. For its time, there are certain aspects of Roots that are still bring home that message. That scene right there is brutal. It is brutal. And Vic Morrow, a tremendous actor, died in a really horrendous accident during the filming of Twilight Zone, the movie, where I believe he was decapitated. Rough road. And actually, he played a racist in that film as well, a racist in that film who ended up having to live the lives of the victims to get an understanding. So that was a pretty interesting role, although it was tragic as to how his life ended. Anyway, folks, let's go to a quick groove. Always giving you the best of urban alternative. This is Alabama Shakes. Hold on, we'll be right back. And hold on.
Come on, friend.
Okay, we're back. Once again, Brittany Howard and the gang, Alabama Shakes, Hold On. Giving you the best of urban alternative music. The call-in number 646-915-9620, 646-915-9620. And while you were holding on, listening to that groove, I got to get the captain involved. Where is the captain? Let's bring him on in. Captain, it's your time.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Yeah, folks, I think everyone in the country is probably aware that there's this internet meme, I think at the top of last month, that involves a 30-second visual clip to this song called the Harlem Shake, and but they're not doing the Harlem Shake of old. It's a pretty funny thing. I mean, the way it works, you wear this mask or you might wear a motorcycle helmet, and you're in a room full of people doing what they're, you know, doing something that unrelated to you dancing. You could be in an office setting, and then some goofball in the middle of the office is dancing by his or herself. And then, let's say, 10 seconds into the music, then everybody goes berserk and starts dancing and just shaking around. I mean, it's pretty goofy, and everyone is in on this meme. Anderson Cooper's in on this meme. T-Pain is in on this meme. Ryan Seacrest is in on this thing. So maybe when those characters get involved, it gets stale. But I think the controversy is that, especially from a documentary on YouTube from Harlem residents, that say, hey, wait a minute. That's not the Harlem Shake from 10 years ago. So it's pretty funny to look at, but I don't know what to think of it. I know it's almost, what, 20 million views, 20-plus million views? So, I don't know. I can't call it. Something else I want to mention, too, Captain, before we get into the topics. I was jogging through the cyber ghetto once again, Captain.
Uh-huh.
I need to stop doing this. Anyway, I'm jogging through Media Takeout, shouting out Sergio, by the way, on this. And I have to confess, I am such a man, Captain, that I can't help myself. But I'm looking at this video. There's this woman. I should have sent this to you. There's this woman who I think is some kind of stripper preacher. You heard me right. I think she's some kind of stripper preacher. And she's, you know, preaching the gospel, you know, mysticism, spookism, Captain. But she's got her breasts, like, half hanging out. Tattoo, I think, is on the right one. But she's got them hanging out, Captain, to such a degree where I think the nipples are actually kind of perching forward. And I think they were. So I was listening to her preach for 4 minutes. I tried to stop myself from looking at this goofy woman. But what is this? I mean, we talk about this all the time, Catherine, about this need to extricate ourselves from spookism, from mysticism. You know, I might as well say I believe that Jor-El sent his only son, Kal-El, to save us from our sin. And I might as well go with that. But it's gotten to the point where we have people who are blatantly hustling us, and we just go along to get along. So now I'm supposed to follow this woman with her breasts hanging out preaching the gospel. Am I supposed to follow this woman? Which I might, but I'm just saying. I was there. Something made me stick around for 4 minutes. Why? To listen to her preach. I wouldn't have gotten the gospel all the way, any other way, Captain. Maybe there's a method to her madness, because I for sure stuck around, and I might revisit that clip again. No, I might. I will. I will say this is the first. I will say this to our audience: go to Media Takeout, look up this thing about this weird preacher woman, and she's preaching. She's preaching with a straight face, mind you. She's preaching with a straight face, but her nipples are hanging out. That's all. We're doomed, incidentally.
She had you underneath a breast spell, not the God spell. A breast spell.
I see Sergio says, oh, yeah, I saw that. Where's the church? And he says, hey, speak for yourself. Preach on, sister. See, now we're tribal now because the breasts are hanging out. I give up on you people. I give up. I'm trying. And because this harlot is preaching the word of God with her breasts hanging out, now you want to go to church. That's it. I'm done. All right, listen, Captain, in all seriousness, but do go to Media Takeout for that. In all seriousness, there is a widening racial wealth gap. I mean, every so often, I think annually, they come out with these figures that make us feel bad. And maybe rightfully so, because now we're learning that the racial wealth gap between African Americans and whites has tripled in the last 30 years. So we've got to get a handle on this. I'm going to read this briefly from the Detroit Free Press. And it says, years after the civil rights movement, racial inequality continues to deepen. The wealth gap between white and African-American families has nearly tripled over 25 years, according to a study released today by the Institute of Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. Although African-American family income has increased over time, white families have accumulated much more wealth. By tracking families, the study found that the gap between white and African-American family wealth increased from $85,000 in 84 to $236,000 in 2009. Many Americans still believe that racial inequality is related to individual behavior, choices, character, marriage, and childbearing, says Thomas Shapiro, IASP director. But home ownership has been the biggest cause of racial wealth disparity, followed by income, study found. In the past 25 years, education has failed to be the great equalizer that many expected. Owning a home has largely benefited white families because they're more able to have family financial assistance for down payments, have easier access to credit, and buy homes years earlier than African-American families. As a result, their home equity has increased, providing more wealth and financial security. I don't know what to say about this. I mean, it's something that is harrowing. It's something that has to be addressed. How would it have gotten worse in 25 years? You know, when we're led to believe that everyone is suffering right now. This is another thing I'm kind of confused about as well, Captain. Explain to me how they're saying that things have worsened between blacks and whites on a financial level when we are led to believe, especially if you listen to conservative radio, that things are worse all around us. I mean, we're in sequestration now, which we may talk about toward the end of the program. We're in the midst of sequestration now, where these cuts are supposed to make things even worse for Americans. So in all this financial strife that's supposed to be dispersed, one would think dispersed among everybody, how is it that the African Americans are still in triple worse circumstances than 25 years ago?
Well, here's one thing that we do know. We do know this, all right? Based on the Census Bureau, by 2016, they say 20% of the U.S. jobs will need a college diploma. Only 20%. That means 80% are not going to need. Now, we also know, based on statistical analysis, people hate when I say that. They hate when I do that. That 25% No, only 25% of the black males here in New York City get a high school diploma. Now, the reason why I have to say high school diploma is because that is the gatekeeper. That is the springboard before you could do anything really based on this society. Because most of you are not going to get your own business. You don't necessarily have to be educated to get your own business. You could be driven. You could do stuff on your own and everything else. Most people are going to work for somebody. So, meaning you have to be able to come through some form of system. It starts at high school. You finish off high school, then you could say, ah, now let me go to the military from there. Let me go on to college from there. Let me go on and get city, state, federal job. And you know, some of these people in the city, state, and federal jobs are making six-figure salaries, and all they have is a high school diploma. We know this. You see correction officers with overtime make six-figure salaries only with a high school diploma. But it starts with at least getting a high school diploma. We go down to the prison system, and you look. Also, we also know about the single-parent household being raised by just your mama. Couple that in there. Go down to the prison system. Most of those individuals do not have at least a high school diploma. Yes, there's a few people who have graduated college, of course. Yes, there are a few, very few lawyers and doctors that do end up in prison. Maybe they beat up their wife or they signed, you know, did some illegal prescriptions. But as a rule, these people are not going to prison. It starts with the high school. Then you can go into the system. And when it comes to us, we're not doing it. We're not doing it. Now, here's the next thing about high school. High school is designed for you to pass, listener, if you attend. It's not like college. College is a different ballgame. You have to be self-motivated. Sometimes it can be expensive, and you have to have a certain level of intelligence and, you know, drive determination, as I said before. But high school, even if you're stupid and you attend, you can pass. They got special ed courses for you. You can get a high school diploma. It's set up that way. So why are we not getting it? Single-parent households, everything else, cultural and everything else that's going on that we get caught up into. Nonsense, foolish means. All that is going on. There's no excuse for it at this given point. And this is something we definitely do know. It's one. It's very huge. This is a big problem because most of you are going to work for somebody. You're going to punch your clock. You're not going to do your own business. As you see some immigrants come here to this country and do very well. They're not educated people. They may have only went to maybe sixth grade in their country. They get a business, they do very well, and they send their kids to school. That's not going to be your way, the way that you do things here as an American. You're going to go about probably a different way. It's something that definitely has to change. Back over to you, Seraphim Nerd.
Yeah, you know, it's really a shame because if you go through the historical record, Captain, you know, there were moments in history, pockets in history, where African-Americans were on the move, where we owned insurance companies, we owned finance companies. You know, of course, we can think about, you know, the story of Rosewood. We can think about Tulsa, Oklahoma, and unfortunately those operations, I think even North Carolina even had its Black Wall Street. There were a number of different Black Wall Streets during the early part of the 20th century, and they were phenomenal. They were phenomenal. They were self-sufficient. They were thriving, but because of the racism at that time, the surrounding whites did not like to see black folk on the come up, and they did their best part to become very violent and to literally burn and bomb those pockets of black wealth out of existence. So we've had moments, and even under Southern segregation, because of those circumstances, we were forced to have black businesses. There was no other way. It's dreadful to think of it this way, Captain. But because of those dire circumstances, you were up against the wall. You had no way but to have a black hospital. You had to have black doctors. You had to have black teachers. You had to have black dentists. Heck, you had to have black hockey teams, black football teams, black baseball teams. And I think behind the scenes at one time, we were saying that the fact, you know, once Jackie Robinson and he has to be applauded, but there's also a negative to his success as well, because once African Americans were allowed to play in mainstream sports, then all those teams which were black businesses, they just went away. What would have been a smarter deal would to have would, for them to still be around, and maybe for them to be absorbed into the mainstream thing. But you had the New York Black Yankees. You know, at some point, why couldn't there have been all these teams? Why couldn't they have been absorbed into? You know, it's one thing for singular black players to be accepted in mainstream sports, but it's another thing for singular black businesses to be accepted in mainstream sports. So that would have been the real integration, the integration on the part of finance, but we never saw that. Nevertheless, the historical record is there, Captain. It is there for people to analyze, to review. But you're right in the sense that at some point, African Americans, Latinos are doing it on a smaller level, but they are doing it. But they're right next to us as far as this income gap is going. But we do see them at least exploring entrepreneurship. And black folks are entrepreneurs too, but entrepreneurs as well, but not to the degree that we need them to be. When you said that most of us are going to be punching the clock, that's problematic in itself. We are going to have to be more entrepreneurial in order to survive. Working with someone else, that's something that is going to have to be explored, extrapolated, and analyzed as to how long are we going to do that. All of us have done it. Maybe there's a time to do that for a brief spell and then learn and then somehow create an infrastructure. So there's a lot of things going on with us culturally, financially, what have you, spiritually, but something has got to change. I mean, in 25 years, things have actually worsened. In 25 years, even with all this strife, financial strife, even with sequestration on the horizon, even with all this chaos, we are still underfoot with other folks on top of us. And I have ideas. I think we have ideas, but how do we go from ideas into action? I don't know. We can talk about it. I think the historical record, as I said, is out there. We can learn. But there's a cultural component that no one wants to talk about that is causing us to be somewhat stagnant. I'll leave it at that. Folks, let's go to a quick groove. There's still more discourse, as always. More new music. This is Hold You Through the Storm. Hold You Through the Storm. We'll be back in a few moments. Let's groove. Thank you. Okay, we're back. Hold You Through the Storm, that was by Freddie Joaquin, incidentally. Freddie Joaquin, he has a CD entitled Fiberglass Kisses, Fiberglass Kisses, and Hold You Through the Storm. Always giving the best of Afropunk, urban alternative, groove, you name it, acid jazz, we will play it. The call-in number is 646-915-9620, again, 646-915-9620. Callers, hold on. Callers, hold on. We'll be with you in a few moments. Let's actually pick up on another topic. You know, I want to talk about actually skipping things around a little bit, Captain. There are two articles from The Root, Henry Louis Gates' The Root.
Uh-huh.
And one is called entitled The White Male Well, it's not entitled. It's about the white male disdain, the white male discomfort, I should say. And I don't want to always talk about race, but because we don't do that all the time here also. But folks know we talk about everything. But sometimes I will go into it when I think it's fascinating. We might have discussed this before, Captain, but I want to get your opinion on this. This is another Hottentot Venus thing. This is another Hottentot Venus thing, Sarah Bartman thing. Folks, always nerdy. Sarah Bartman, a.k.a. Hottentot Venus, was an African woman, I believe during the 18th century, that was somewhat of a circus act. And she was a circus act because of her posterior. Because, I guess because of the protrusion of her bottom, it caused a stir. People didn't know what it was. I should say whites did not know what it was at that time. And they carted her around as a circus act because of her bottom. She was a freak at that time. Now they'll give you a reality show. If you think about Kim Kardashian, she's gotten a reality show because of her bottom. If you think of J-Lo, she's gotten record deals and movie deals because of her bottom. I mean, that was not just because of that, but there seems to be a lot of fascination because of her bottom. So now we're seeing there's been quite a bit of disdain toward Mrs. Obama. The actual title of the piece from The Root is called Why White Men Are Obsessed with the First Lady's Butt. By Janae Desmond Harris. Why white men are obsessed with the first lady's butt. And I think obsessed in a negative way. And it does come up ever so often about this woman's posterior. She's on this fitness campaign, and somehow, you know, and I'm saying this with a conservative bent. We all conservatives are not the same. And I am disturbed by those Republicans who seem to have a problem with the Obamas beyond politics. They will never stick to the policy. And this is where you lose. You lose when you get away from the policy. And they talk about her posterity because, well, she's too big, allegedly, too big to discuss health. And Mrs. Obama is far from obese, but she does have a prototypical black woman's physique. Now, we've seen her, and she has wonderful arms. I mean, the physicality of her blackness, black femaleness, is a problem with these people. I'm going to read this briefly. I want the captain to weigh in. This is from The Root. High school football coach Bob Grisham of Alabama was surreptitiously recorded by one of his students making inappropriate but unfortunately also familiar comments about the First Lady's body. The Washington Post Krista Thompson reports, fat butt Michelle Obama, Grisham said. Look at her. She looks like she weighs 185 or 190. She's overweight. Bonus, he also made disparaging comments about gay people in the same recording. Sounds like a really great role model. Out of line and hateful remarks about the Let's Move Founders Anatomy are, of course, nothing new. Think Rush Limbaugh's frequent references to Michelle My Butt Obama, and Representative F. James Sensenbrenner's apology for discussing her large posterior. I think we spoke about it as well. Captain, what do you think is going on here? I mean, she's not obese. But what do we have to pretend that black and brown women don't have large bottoms?
Well, let's look at it this way. There's two schools of thought. It's what the powers that be say on the up high, then there's what happens on the down low. Now, let's go back in time before 1865, when, according to historians, according to some historians, when they said that black people were subhuman, what would make the slave master leave his nice woman in the bed, slave master was white, leave his nice woman in the bed, and go, you know, do his little thing with the slave female that's supposed to be a subhuman? So there was disdain, but it was also attraction. You're doing your thing on the down low, but on the up high, you're a subhuman. Now, if we're to believe that some of the people, not all of the people, some of the powers that be today are descendants of some of these slave masters, some of these same means are going to be there. Means passed through generation and also culturally through the same people. Some of this same ideology is going to be there. So in the modern day era, circa 2013, you have both schools of thought. You have what a Rush Limbaugh will say on the up high, but who knows what he may do on the down low. So there is a disdain, but I think there's also an attraction on the down low. So you're getting it both ways, and it's a fight amongst them at the same time. We shouldn't have to go there in 2013, but we have the history. Just saying. Just saying. That's all. Back over to you, Sir Afro Nerd.
Yeah, I was listening to a conversation. It was actually an interview, I should say, on Howard Stern, SiriusXM, and he was interviewing Donald Trump. And as much as I am a supporter of Howard Stern as far as his radio personality prowess, I found it fascinating in the sense that they got into a conversation about Kim Kardashian. And we know the type of woman or women that Howard Stern likes, and we know the type of women that Donald Trump likes. They were talking rather despairingly about Kim Kardashian, about her physique in particular. And they kept on going on and on about how they couldn't find her attractive. They didn't see what all the hoopla was about. And it felt, they didn't say this, but it felt like they were talking about a black woman. It felt that way because, let's face it, her appeal is very much a black appeal, isn't it? I find Kim Kardashian attractive physically. I do. Now, I can't speak for her personality. I can't speak for what she represents, but physically I don't see what they see. And I do have an issue with who determines what is attractive. Now, I'm not into obese women. I will say that right away. I'm not into obese women. I do like a physically fit woman. Matter of fact, woman. I do like different types of women. I do like different physical attributes in women. I do have a problem with obesity. Michelle Obama is not an obese woman. So I find it immature for a woman who is obviously has some physical prowess. We see what her arms look like. She's 5'10". She's 5'10". So she's a big girl, but she's not an obese woman. And I appreciate the fact that she does promulgate fitness. But I would not want her as a first lady to be some Pop-Tart. I wouldn't want her to be a Pop-Tart. And I think even among whites, even in mainstream culture, like you said, there's attraction and repulsion. I think there's a lot of confusion as to what is considered attractive because Kim Kardashian gets paid between $40 and $60 million a year, and it's not because she's ugly. Let's be straight up about that. That's not what's going down. And same thing with J-Lo. J-Lo is a multimillionaire. And the fact that we're seeing butt injections, we're seeing women of all strata getting these dangerous butt injections. So is the plump rear attractive or unattractive? I'm confused on it. I mean, we see these runway models, but I don't think the runway models are really representative of what the average American male would be into. I think the average American male, really, black or white, average now, I think they kind of dig Kim Kardashian because her Q rating substantiates that, doesn't it, Captain? How can someone be so popular and so, quote-unquote, unattractive and get paid $50 or $60 million a year? And they can't stop talking about a rear. Something is very odd. Something is very odd in Denmark. I'm just saying. Now, there's another article from The Root, staying on this race thing, that is entitled, "Forget Offensive Comments. I'm concerned with what's not said to black women." I'm on this women thing because we are in the midst of Women's History Month. We just finished Black History Month. Now we're on Women's History Month. So I'm going to focus a little bit on the fairer sex. So again, with The Root, the article is entitled, Forget Offensive Comments. I'm concerned with what's not said to black women. And this woman, if I can pronounce her name correctly, Christiana Bakwe, I think. Maybe the M is silent, like the D is silent in Django, Captain. Christiana Bakwe. And she goes in on this supposition that black women, even when they succeed in academia, or rather when they have the grades, when their blackness is known, they may have difficulty in getting into certain educational institutions, even when the grades are there, because of their blackness and their femaleness. The reason why I mention this article is because actually of an offhand comment by The Oracle. The Oracle, again, folks, the tangential producer of the show, I think that's his tagline, and my father, he just kind of said off the cuff, he was getting into one of his I can't stand black folks rants, which we all get into these rants. It's one of those Afro Nerd Radio Unchained, Afro Nerd Radio After Dark conversations. I can't stand black folks. And it was him. It was hinged on this idea of constant victimization. Constant victimization. Sometimes I get tired of it. I mention this article because there were commenters to this piece that opened up about maybe we have to stop complaining and start doing. If we know these things exist, if we know these difficulties exist, not that we can't talk about them, but we can't always stay in analysis mode. Sometimes you're going to have to reboot and go into active mode. Let me read a little bit from this article, and then I want to open this up. It says, an article published by The Guardian this week revealed that white applicants are twice as likely to be granted admission to Oxford University than ethnic minorities, even when they have the same A-level grades. My friends and I weren't alone. There's a trend. This, again, is from the writer. Despite what's being said to your face in interviews, that you are smart, capable, poised, etc., something's being unsaid, resulting in negative outcomes behind the scene. It's the unsaid that really scares me. Yesterday I read an article on XO Jane entitled, 10 Things Every Non-Black Person Should Know by Now About Black Women. A few weeks before there was a How Not to Be a Male Anatomy to Your Black Friend. I'd also read How Not to Be a Male Anatomy to Your Fat Friends and 10 Things Straight People Should Say That Makes Me Want to Throttle Them. Beyond the fact that I feel these How Not to Do articles can go on until infinity, all of them have left me being and feeling conflicted. At the risk of conflating, I'll say the vein that runs throughout all these pieces is a variant of the same theme. strong, smart women from groups that society has thrust other status on, explain to the majority, implicitly white and male, how to speak to them. I'm aware of the frustrating, insipid, are you kidding me encounters anyone who's deemed a minority regularly has with people who are willingly or unintentionally ignorant. All right, basically what she's saying is, there are things about black people that go unsaid, and it's business as usual. You know, welcome to the world. This is what goes on. When they see your black face, there are actions, there are motives that are going on that you have no control over. So what do you do? Do you mire in victimization, or do you go somewhere else? Maybe Oxford isn't for you. I know Oxford has that reputation. I understand that. But one of the commenters, Captain, had said that, well, you know, there's plenty of black colleges, black universities, historically black colleges you can go to. You don't have to go to Oxford. It would be nice. It's not that you should not attempt to go to Oxford. But, hey, you know, if you can, I hear this all the time. And with the Oracle having made that offhanded comment, I think there is something about being stuck in victimization mode. What are your thoughts on this?
Now I have to go back in time once again. So excuse me on that. But
also, one quick thing. I'm sorry, as Paula called up, and I believe I was ranting. The lines are open. 646-915-9620, 646-915-9620. The lines are open. Go ahead, Captain.
Yes, I have to go back in time again, but I go backwards in order to go forwards. Coming out of slavery, 1865. I free you, and you're nothing more than a freed slave. Now, you're the descendants of freed slaves, and the powers that be treat you as thus. That's the reality of it. And you should get this message. We should be getting this message already. It's a nice article and everything, but that meme is supposed to be driven home at this given point. Today's operative word, by the way, in case you didn't know, is meme. Meme. Everybody say it with me. Okay, that meme should be driven home at this given point. The victimization mentality, woe is me, will not get you anywhere. It will not get you anywhere. You have to get up and do for yourself. Actually, what you have to do is go even harder, because this is how the gatekeepers are going to treat you. That's the reality of it. That's the reality of it. Back over to you, Sir Affleck.
All right, let's go to another groove, and I want to talk about this another operative word, Captain, hullabaloo, with Antonin Scalia. He showed his real colors, I think, this time, about the Voting Rights Act and about Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act by saying that it was a racial entitlement. He's tired of all this racial entitlement with black folks voting. Well, I'm putting in the black folks voting part. He didn't put that part in there. But my dear Sonia Sotomayor put some fire on him. Put some fire on his buttocks. We got to talk about this briefly, but it's pretty startling about how some folks, how we are still fighting. This is what I'm talking about, victimization. We're still fighting. You still don't give up the fight. Even though we're talking about 47 years now, 48 years now since the Voting Rights Act has been put into play, and there are still folks and forces that still want to prevent black, brown, minority, women from voting. That's why you still need it. But, as a conservative, I'm going to say this. Your time is waning. They are looking, because what has happened, as much as I appreciate the presidency of Barack Obama, it has become problematic because now it gives an argument, whether it's valid or not, Captain. It gives an argument that, well, equality has arrived. We have a black president. We have a black family White House. That is the apex of one can make the argument. That is the apex of equality. You folks have arrived. You have no more excuses. That is what this really is about. When you do see high profile people of color in positions that you never saw before, it lends credence to people like Antonin Scalia to come out with this kind of backward thinking. And it's going to come to a point where we may end up losing this stuff. We may end up losing that. All right, going to a quick groove. This is Alan Evans, Do It Again. Do It Again. We'll be right back. Hard to extricate myself from that groove once again. It's called Do It Again. Alan Evans, Do It Again. Folks, we've got about 6 minutes remaining. So we'll try to hit as much as we can with this issue. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 is in jeopardy, or at least Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And I want to play this clip briefly from the Young Turks where they get in on Antonin Scalia, who is, of course, one of the Supreme Court justices. He's on the has a conservative bent, and just as Sotomayor has a liberal bent. It makes me wonder, as we see Pope Benedict exiting, as we see him exiting, these lifelong positions, these jobs for life, these jobs for life, they may have to be revisited. Certainly. Certainly. Scalia is a he's an a-hole. I'll censor myself on that. Listen, if you want to argue something, argue it in a succinct manner. Throwing out racial, the term, what was the word he exactly used? He said racial, it wasn't preferences. Let's go to the clip, I can find it. But his terminology is problematic. You know, that's how these liberals will get you. If you misspeak, then you have lost the argument. That is it. That's what it is. When you misspeak, you lose the argument. Okay, this is the Young Turks on this Scalia and the Voting Rights Act. Hold on, folks.
Voting Rights Act passed in 1965. Actually, there's a moving speech by Lyndon Johnson when he passed it. It's video 11 that I want to show you guys. You know, obviously, in 1965, we had a totally different country. And we still had the colored water fountains. The Civil Rights Act had just been passed. And it was a bloody struggle to get there. And that struggle was in mid-process. And there was the Jim Crow laws. And voting by blacks were discouraged in 100 different ways in the South and other portions of the country as well. If you don't know, the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, also applies to some portions of California, New York, New Hampshire, Florida, et cetera. It's not just the South, and obviously Florida is to some degree in the South, but it is all across the country where we had a pattern of racial discrimination, and that's what Lyndon Johnson was fighting back against.
Today is a triumph for freedom as huge as any victory that's ever been won on any battlefield. They came in darkness, and they came in chains. And today, we strike away the last major shackle of those fierce and ancient bonds.
So that's very powerful stuff. Now, people say, hey, listen, the country's changed a lot since 1965. And of course it has. Now, we wish that it had changed more, but just in this last election, we just saw that there was an attempt to get minorities to vote less through voter ID laws, etc. That was a non-existent issue of voter fraud. In fact, one of the counties that's been trying to do it quite often is Shelby County, Alabama, who brought the case to the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court heard today. And Justice Sotomayor pointed out the irony of Shelby County, Alabama, bringing this when the Justice Department had to regulate back in 2008, which is not that long ago, telling them that they were doing racial discrimination again, where they had done a new scheme there where they wiped out all the black legislators in that area. What a wonderful coincidence that turned out to be, and that was ruled illegal. So they're a little hurt about that. Now, you have to understand that as recently as 2006, when we had the Bush administration and totally controlled Republican Congress, the Voting Rights Act was reaffirmed for the next 25 years, and the vote wasn't even remotely close. It was 390-33 in the House, and the Senate, it was unanimous. When does that ever happen? 98-0, right? But today, when the Supreme Court was deciding whether that was unconstitutional.
Folks, we have under 2 minutes, so we're going to have to pick this up on Wednesday. Captain, any remarks on that? I mean, again, we're talking about trying to fight for something that should be inalienably, what can I speak, ours. It should not have to be fighting for the right to vote 50 years almost later. But yet we still are. And the state that it comes from, as was said on the Young Turks, they are the main the main perpetrators of voting fraud, or not voting fraud, but trying to prevent minorities from voting, voter ID laws and that kind of thing. They're the main perps for the reasoning why you still have to have Section 5. They're the main perps of that. Captain.
Very interesting, to say the least. Very interesting. Have to pick this up definitely on Wednesday so we can expound upon it a lot further.
Yeah. All right. Listen, folks, it's been real. We always enjoy doing this, when I can speak, that is. All right, let's move on out. This is Kendra Morris. Shine on, you crazy diamond. Shine on, you crazy diamond, for you Pink Floyd fans, her soulful rendition. See you on Wednesday. Thanks.
Thank you.